Welcome to the First Light Podcast with excerpts from our Friday, April 2nd radio broadcast. Hello, I'm Michael Toscano, and it's First Light with our unique blend of news and information and talk. Much of that news this morning coming from Washington and a courtroom in Minneapolis. There, the trial of the police officer charged with murdering George Floyd offered information and video new to the public. The detailed look at the gruesome death becoming clearer as the prosecution builds its case. In Washington, the Biden administration building its case for the $2 trillion American Jobs Plan with unanimous rejection from Republicans so far. Later in this hour, we'll get into that new Gallup poll showing for the first time ever that fewer than half of Americans belong to a church, a synagogue, or mosque. Are we losing our faith or just the desire to formalize it? And a look at how a health organization in Philadelphia is seeking to erase disparities in access to health care caused by race. Money, a weekend movie, sports and weather, all ahead for you. The Early View at First Light. A Minneapolis police supervisory sergeant on duty the night George Floyd died under former officer Derek Chauvin's knee testified at Chauvin's murder trial that the officers who restrained Floyd should have ended it once he stopped resisting. That's just one of the important moments at Bay 3 of testimony, reported for First Light by correspondent Kathy Foster.
Paramedic Derek Smith testified about what he saw when he arrived on the scene outside Cup Foods in Minneapolis, the convenience store where a cashier claimed George Floyd used a counterfeit $20 bill to buy cigarettes on May 25th of last year. He said he saw Floyd on the ground and three police officers on top of him as he checked Floyd for vital signs.
I suspected this patient to be dead.
Okay.
In lay terms.
Fire Captain Jeremy Norton took the stand and said Floyd seemed to be gone before they were able to help him.
We did pulse checks multiple times from when we arrived until we arrived at the stab room at HCMC.
Did anyone ever find a pulse?
No, ma'am.
Floyd's former girlfriend, Courtney Ross, shed tears. She testified she had been in a relationship with Floyd since August of 2017. They remained together until his death, and they both struggled with opioid addiction.
It's a classic story of how many people get addicted to opioids. We both suffered from chronic pain. We got addicted and tried really hard to break that addiction.
The defense also asked about an incident 2 months before Floyd's death when he made an emergency trip to the hospital.
You later learned that that was due to an overdose?
Yes.
And did you learn what caused that overdose?
No.
At that time frame, did you learn that Mr. Floyd was taking anything other than opioids?
No.
You did not know that he had taken heroin at that time?
No.
The defense plans to make the case that Floyd died of drug use and unrelated medical issues and argues that Chauvin was following proper police protocol. But when Derek Chauvin's former supervisor took the stand, retired Sergeant David Pluger of the Minneapolis Police Department testified the force used by officers on Floyd should have ended earlier.
When Mr. Floyd was no longer offering up any resistance to the officers, they could have ended the restraint.
Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to charges of second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. I'm Kathy Foster.
Thanks, Kathy. It is 10 minutes past the hour, and it's First Light. President Joe Biden is facing what may turn into a full-on battle with Republicans over his $2 trillion blueprint to revitalize America's infrastructure. And while support from his Democratic Party is strong, there isn't necessarily unanimous agreement over some of the elements, including how to pay for it. The Democratic chairman of the tax-writing House Ways and Means Committee, Congressman Richard Neal of North Carolina, says there may have to be changes there. Capitol Hill correspondent Linda Kenyon tells us how the battle is shaping up this morning. Linda?
Michael, everyone wants better roads and bridges, but who wants to pick up the tab? President Biden has unveiled an infrastructure plan that could cost at least $2 trillion spread over a period of up to 10 years. It would include improvements to roads and bridges, expand broadband, and invest in climate-friendly technologies. Separate parts of the bill would include improvements to healthcare and the American workforce.
President Biden is undertaking something in the tradition of thinking big, being transformational, and creating jobs for America.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi defending the plan.
Infrastructure needs are self-evident. The American Society of Civil Engineers has demonstrated that we're trillions of dollars behind. There's no more expensive maintenance than no maintenance.
But how should the federal government pay for that maintenance? The president's plan calls for raising the corporate tax rate from its current 21% to 28%. No way, says Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
That package that they're putting together now, as much as we would like to address infrastructure, is not going to get support from our side.
Speaking in his home state, the Kentucky Republican senator said the bill also is misdirected.
I'm going to fight him every step of the way because I think this is the wrong prescription for America.
Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg says it's exactly the right prescription for America.
This is a moment for the United States to decide. Are we in fact going to continue to lead the world? Or are we going to be just another country? If we want to lead the world, we have to have world-class infrastructure for the American people.
Speaking on CNN, Secretary Buttigieg added that he's thrilled by the boldness of the bill. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says if Republicans support infrastructure, but they don't support ways to pay for it,
maybe they have different alternative ideas.
And Psaki says the president wants to hear those ideas.
We feel there are a lot of areas of agreement, and the president will certainly be inviting Republicans and Democrats here to the Oval Office to have discussions and meetings about the path forward to hear their ideas.
White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain, meanwhile, says the president would like a bipartisan agreement on an infrastructure bill. But he's not ruling out passing the bill in the Senate through the process of reconciliation, which would require only a simple majority vote. Linda Kenyon, Washington.
You may be out and about this weekend, so checking on Easter travel and egg hunt weather conditions. Let's bring in our old friend, AccuWeather meteorologist Brian Thompson. Brian, how's the weekend weather looking?
Well, things are looking fairly quiet across the entire country. The weather's about as quiet as it can get. We have a very large area of high pressure over the eastern half of the country that's basically pushing any rain or snow off to the east. Today, high temperatures only in the 30s in much of interior New England, and we'll see highs in the 40s all the way down through Virginia, even into parts of North Carolina. And this is an air mass that really makes its way all the way down the East Coast. High today only 58 in Jacksonville. But on the flip side, it's kind of a tale of two extremes. We're seeing some very warm weather along the West Coast. We've been flirting with some record highs in parts of California. And once again today, highs getting well into the 80s in the San Joaquin Valley. And we're talking about highs in the 90s today and some places the upper 90s in parts of the deserts of Southern California. And Phoenix today looking to hit 90 degrees. Again, for today, a fairly quiet weather map shaping up for today. Just have a few spotty showers near the tidewater of Virginia and maybe a few spotty showers in some of the higher elevations of Arizona and New Mexico. And the weather is going to stay fairly quiet as we head through the upcoming weekend as well.
Thanks, Brian Thompson. According to police in Orange, California, the suspect they say killed four people, including a 9-year-old boy at a business complex Wednesday night, had professional and personal relationships with the victims. A police spokesperson saying this was not a random act of violence. The New York Times is reporting that the Justice Department investigation into Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz and an already indicted Florida politician is focusing on their involvement with a number of women who were recruited online for sex and received cash payments. Investigators are said to believe that Joel Greenberg, the former tax collector in Seminole County, Florida, introduced the women to Mr. Gaetz, who also had sex with them. Gaetz denies paying for sex and having sex with an underage girl, which is also under investigation. Robert Workman's with us.
Michael, baseball's opening day on Thursday, a little something for everybody. Tigers trimmed the Indians 3-2, Miguel Cabrera with a home run in the snow at Comerica Park. Rays shut out the Marlins 1-0, Tyler Glasnow and the Tumblers with a three-hitter, Austin Meadows' eighth-inning solo shot, the only run of the day. Early excitement, Cardinals crushed the Reds 11-6, Dylan Carlson's three-run dinger capped a six-run first inning. Royals overpowered the Rangers 14-10. Both teams put up a five spot in the first. Padres blew a 6-1 lead, but came back to top the Diamondbacks 8-7. Pirates powered past the Cubs 5-3. Cabrian Hayes with a first-inning rocket. Rockies rolled the Dodgers 8-5. Only one homer at Coors Field, and it didn't count. Cody Bellinger passed Justin Turner on the bases after Turner mistakenly thought the ball had been caught. No homer, Bellinger called out by rule, even though it was Turner's goof. Four games went extra innings, all ended in the 10th with the designated runner scoring. Blue Jays shaded the Yankees 3-2, Phillies down the Braves 3-2, Brewers beat the Twins 6-5, Milwaukee scored three in the bottom of the 9th just to force extras, and the Mariners got by the Giants 8-7 on a bases-loaded walk. Also out west, the Angels scored two in the 8th to trim the White Sox 4-3, and the Astros axed the A's 8-1. Two games postponed, Orioles and Red Sox were rained out. They'll try again today. Mets Nationals called off after two more Nats players tested positive for COVID. One player had received a positive test after the team flew home from spring training. The game will be made up later this season. NBA Thursday, the Nets swatted the Hornets. Brooklyn has won four in a row, 20 of 23 to lead the East. 76ers clubbed the Cavaliers to keep pace. They're just a half game back. Nuggets sank the Clippers. Magic downed the Pelicans in overtime. Hawks outlasted the Spurs in double OT. Pistons punished the Wizards and the Heat held off the Warriors. College basketball championship weekend. The women's Final Four is tonight. South Carolina and Stanford, followed by Connecticut and Arizona. Then Saturday, the men's Final Four in Indianapolis. Baylor against Houston and Gonzaga versus UCLA. Roy Williams announced his retirement as North Carolina basketball coach. The 70-year-old Hall of Famer, the only coach to lead two schools to 400 wins. Kansas, where he took four teams to the Final Four, and the Tar Heels, whom he guided to three national titles. 903 wins in all, that's fourth all time. NHL Lightning shaded the Blue Jackets 3-2, Panthers zinged the Red Wings 3-2 in overtime, and the Hurricanes nipped the Blackhawks 4-3. Tampa Bay, Florida, and Carolina, not only the top three teams in the Central Division, they're now 1-2-3 in the entire NHL. Also wins last night for the Rangers, Penguins, Islanders, Canadiens, Stars, and Wild. That's Friday Sports.
Of course, on Friday mornings, we're always thinking, you know, movie theaters are opening up. Maybe there's something worth seeing. Kevin Carr is going to tell us now if we want to go see The Unholy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Michael. This is a horror movie. It's a PG-13 horror movie. So it's a studio picture. For people who are big horror movie fans, that kind of makes a difference, R versus PG-13, independent versus studio. So it's a studio picture, and they're dropping it, of course, in the oddest week you would expect for a horror movie, which, of course, is Easter weekend. They're sort of promoting it that way. But it's based on a book from the 80s from England, and it's about a guy who finds a what would be like a miracle, sort of a sight miracle, where he stumbles onto this story. He's a journalist and he stumbles onto this story about a girl who is deaf, and she's amazingly healed when she's having visions of the Virgin Mary. And then, of course, people start to flock to this little church there in Massachusetts. But then, of course, you know, it's never going to work out great in a horror movie. So we find out that there's something sinister behind this, masquerading as something holy. And it's up to the journalist to try and convince people and stop it and change things that he has kind of put in motion, which makes it an interesting movie. I've always found these sort of films fascinating. I have a love for these sort of either, you know, exorcism type movies. It's not as extreme as The Exorcist, but it's a nice little thriller.
Well, I'm watching the trailer, and it's like every cheesy stereotype for this kind of movie. You know, you're looking at this young lady, and then her eyes, the pupils of her eyes pop black, and then you see black blood coming from a statue's eyes and creepy statues. And, you know, it just seems like, okay, it's like, well, we let's take out the book of horror tropes and run right through them. And so it just looked kind of unoriginal to me.
Well, and you get that at times. That's why I prefaced it with saying it's a studio movie and it's PG-13. You expect a certain degree of paint by numbers at that point. But no one ever said that Hollywood wasn't formulaic. It plays the formula. It does take it from a different angle because of the idea of finding a place that becomes a site that people are going to flock to, rather than it just being, you know, Reagan from The Exorcist, you know, needing to have the priest come to them. So I think it gives an interesting perspective. It's not great for if you like that independent horror, but if you don't mind a little bit of, you know, like I said, paint by number studio horror, I enjoyed it. I thought it was different enough from the other things I've seen. And the cast with like Jeffrey Dean Morgan and Cary Elwes, they do a good job. And I actually was pleasantly surprised with this one.
Well, in the trailer, it says, be careful who you pray to. And that's always good advice, I guess.
Yes.
There's that. How many black tears for The Unholy in theaters this weekend?
I'm going to give it 3 out of 5 black tears. Like I said, it's not perfect, but it's, at least it did what it wanted to do for me.
Major League Baseball is discussing the status of its 2021 All-Star Game in Atlanta as more corporations are coming out in opposition to Georgia's new voting laws. The league says they're gathering feedback from teams and executives about the matter before coming to a decision about potentially relocating the game. Baseball's Midsummer Classic is scheduled for July 13 at Truist Park, home of the Atlanta Braves. This is Friday on First Light.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.
The pandemic has exposed some fault lines in American healthcare, including differing resources for and outcomes for minority populations. We've known they were there, but the virus has brought these fault lines into stark relief. We're going to meet somebody in just a few minutes who's been working on this for a long time and is now showing results. Ahead right now, though, is CNBC's Peter Schachnow with a check on Friday Morning Money.
Good morning, Michael. It will be a quiet day on Wall Street, but not completely quiet. The markets are closed for Good Friday, but the government will be issuing the March employment report. This happens every few years because of the strict schedule for the jobs report. It is always released on the third Friday after the week that contains the 12th of the month. That's the week that the household surveys are taken. Consensus forecasts are predicting that the U.S. economy added 675,000 jobs last month, with the unemployment rate falling to 6% from 6.2%. Of course, whatever the numbers show, there will not be any market reaction until Monday. Meanwhile, the shortened trading week was a bullish one, highlighted by a record high for the S&P 500, which passed 4,000 for the first time ever. That got April off to a bullish start, which is not unusual. The S&P 500 has been up for the last 8 Aprils in a row, highlighted by a nearly 13% surge last year as the market rebounded from its pandemic lows in late March. Peter Schachnow, CNBC.
One of the things that the pandemic has brought back to our attention, it's something we've heard about, we've known about, but it really put it in stark relief, and that's the disparity in health outcomes based on neighborhoods, based on racial composition, things like that. And it's been a problem, not only just in terms of dealing with the sickness itself, but even things like rolling out the vaccines. But there is an organization that is trying to overcome those barriers. And it's the Lazarex Cancer Foundation's Community Impact Program. We're joined now by Dana Dornseif, CEO of the Cancer Foundation. She's joining us now on First Light to explain how the program works, how you came to it. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So you heard me talking about the disparities in outcomes and in terms of reaching people based on various demographic things, especially race, neighborhoods, poverty levels, and that sort of thing. So tell me how this program, the Impact Program, came into being.
Sure. Well, Lazarex Cancer Foundation for the past 15 years has really been focused on connecting cancer patients to cancer clinical trials. And inherently in cancer clinical trials, we have a challenge around achieving diversity in participation. And so in the course of doing our work, we decided we really needed to, focus on addressing the disparities and the lack of diversity in cancer clinical trials. We decided that we wanted to take a very methodical approach to a long existing problem and see if we could actually fix the problem in a sustainable way. And fortunately, I'm a Drexel graduate, a Drexel alum. And so, great, strong relationships with Drexel University. So I approached Drexel and asked if they would partner with us in the community impact program, where we could do work in the very poor African-American and Black neighborhoods in West Philadelphia to engage with the community members and actually work to overcome a lot of the fear and the mistrust that has built up over many, many decades, you know, to try and improve cancer health outcomes.
Are you having to create a new tradition of getting regular early checkups, even if you don't feel any symptoms?
Absolutely. So especially for people for whom, you know, cancer runs in their family, early detection is key. The earlier we detect cancer, the better the prognosis for survival is. Unfortunately, amongst our communities of color, many times the reason that they have worse outcomes than their white counterparts is because they are detected later. So the sooner we can get patients in, the, you know, for screening, the better we are in relation to our being able to have a positive outcome in cancer treatment.
I guess that the physical embodiment of this impact program that you've established is the Cancer Wellness Hub, where people can come. So what is different about this clinic from the standard clinic that most of us are familiar with?
So the Cancer Wellness Hub actually isn't a clinic. It's actually a safe space for community members to come and gather and talk about their questions, their concerns, their issues in relation to cancer. And it covers the entire continuum of cancer care, not just treatment, but prevention. You know, 40% of cancers are preventable. And that's the greatest gift we can give someone, is to allow them, you know, to not get cancer at all, right? Diet. Lifestyle, risk, right? Moving, exercising, all of these things can have a tremendous impact on if you do or if you don't get cancer. Screenings, you know, we talk about the importance of screenings. We actually help get people to screenings so they can take advantage of early diagnosis. And then we also identify the treatment pathway. For patients, we deal with insurance concerns, and then ultimately clinical trial participation if that becomes, you know, part of the equation and a person has to participate in a clinical trial. So it's really a place where people can come and develop continuity in relationships and get all of their questions answered. And, you know, it's like it's literally a hub that brings all of the resources within the community within the reach of the community members.
How can people get information about this?
Well, we are here to help. The easiest way is to go onto our website, which is lazarex.org, and that's LAZAREX.org, and you will see all of the patient services that we offer. And if we can help, give us a call and we'll help any way we can.
Dana Dornsife is the CEO of the Lazarex Cancer Foundation, and we certainly appreciate you bringing this news to our listeners this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Michael. I appreciate the opportunity.
The quickest way for the economy to recover, for business to return, for concerts and theaters to reopen, for generations of families to reunite, for children to play freely with other children, is for everyone to get the vaccine. It's America's best shot. A message from Westwood One.
By the way, you're planning to go to a church this weekend for Easter Sunday. Do you belong to a church or a synagogue or a mosque? The Gallup poll now says fewer than half of Americans, 47%, do belong, and the drop-off gets steeper and steeper the younger people are. Does that mean we're losing our faith or just don't need to have a formal affiliation to express it? Let's talk about it now with Dr. Timothy O'Malley, Director of Education at the McGrath Institute for Church Life. That's at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. Tim, thanks for being with us on First Light.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So is it that we are losing faith or just losing our desire to be part of a club?
Well, we don't know. So the Gallup poll reveals to us that fewer people are involved in belonging to concrete religious practice through joining to a sort of congregation, but we don't know if there are fewer people involved in religion as a whole. There are some numbers that point towards that, including a rise to what we call the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, but it's not clear yet that we've lost religion as a country.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have lost faith in a lot of institutions. A lot of clubs and associations are seeing drop-offs in membership. Could it just be related to that, in general, we are not as interested in being part of those little communities?
Americans are certainly not interested in institutions as a whole, and we have good reason to be wary of them, right? So if we look at Congress, if you look at the Supreme Court, certainly, you know, my own institution, the Roman Catholic Church, has had sexual abuse crises. We've had other sort of concerns related to hierarchy. So there's things that need to be addressed. And so I think Americans right now are just distrustful of an array of institutions, which, of course, includes organized religion.
I guess the thing that's concerning for the future is that the church membership is really related strongly to age. And it's the younger people, the younger generations, the younger that you get, the less likely they are to belong to a church, so that it's the oldest people who are the most likely to belong to a church. So that points to a problem in keeping churches alive in the future, I would think.
Yeah, well, it certainly does. And, you know, organized religion needs to figure out what they're going to do about this. But I'd say two things real quickly. First of all, it's not necessarily surprising that older people are more involved in religion than younger people. This may have always been the case. In fact, we've only been tracking generations really since generations are a 1920s phenomenon. And so we have to recognize the fact that only after World War I do we have generations. So is it the case that younger people are by nature less religious? We just don't entirely know. But second, I think the question is, will younger people come back even if they're less involved? And we also don't know that, right? So it depends on what churches do, the kind of outreach they do to millennials, of which I am technically a millennial as a 40 year old. I'm technically a millennial, but we don't know if Gen Y can also be reached if the church determines ways of doing outreach.
All right. Well, the United States has always been thought of and described as a religious nation. And it looks like Gallup says that about 7 in 10 of us are affiliated at least maybe informally with some type of organized religion, even if fewer than half of us now, you know, have signed, you know, on the line and have a formal membership in a specific house of worship. Do the houses of the traditional religions, do they have to now compete with people who are just, it's a more a la carte experience? I feel like sampling this today, or I feel like that approach today, is that where we're going?
So I think there was an argument that was in fact where we were going in the 90s. This was the sort of narrative that there was American religiosity was marked by a kind of market approach. I think Americans have always been more reluctant, I should say, to embrace a particular religious body. It's the same reason why Americans are often reluctant to say that they're a Democrat or a Republican. There wants to be sort of independence of spirit. I think Americans traditionally, still relative to Europe, are interested in the existence of God and the spiritual life. And so there's not a sort of departure from that, even if there is a departure from, okay, I'm going to go to this parish every week for the rest of my life. And I think that's really the phenomenon that the Gallup poll is analyzing.
Well, the Catholic Church has had a sharper drop-off than Protestant churches, and Gallup sort of apologizes and said, based on our resources, we are primarily focused on Catholics and Protestants here when they get into the asking very specific questions. Now, we know that the Catholic Church has had its troubles in recent years, and so you might understand why that has happened. And it's interesting that the Protestant churches have maintained a stronger, steadier relationship with their parishioners. And I'm wondering what's causing the difference there.
I think Catholicism is the most institutional of religions, right? If you think about institutional, if you reject an institution, can you think of an institution that's more institutional than Catholicism, right? So while you may, you know, be able to, for example, go to a Quaker church, you don't have to worry about the institution of Quakerism in the same way that you would with, well, your parish is affiliated with the diocese, which is affiliated with an archdiocese, which is affiliated, of course, with a metropolitan area, which is affiliated, of course, eventually up to Rome. So it's the most institutional of religious bodies.
All right. Well, Dr. Timothy O'Malley is the Director of Education at the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thanks for inviting me.
And that's the First Light Podcast with excerpts from our Friday, April 2nd radio broadcast. Thanks to producer TJ Coutini. I'm Michael Toscano. Check out our full show on the air at one of America's great radio stations near you every weekday morning. And come back here for the First Light Podcast.